Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-hosts, as always, Connor Rebush. Him, folks. All right, we're moving right along to...
What? What's wrong?
Nothing.
That went just as we rehearsed.
Yes. Totally rehearsed that. We're talking this week about the UFC on ESPN card going down. Where else but that beautiful Apex Center in Las Vegas, Nevada?
The historic Apex Center in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Only half of it right now taken up by bulk t-shirt orders waiting to be shipped.
And a certain closet that is full of the corpses of power slap contestants.
Oh, they don't keep those. They just dump them.
No, those go into their new line of fighter food.
Dana makes sure to get the gold teeth out of them. Yeah. And then after that, yeah, they go into the Performance Institute has its own kitchen and they do like offer prepared meals.
You get complimentary snacks if you're a Contender Series fighter. Mine has a hair in it. It's actually covered in hairs.
They actually at one point sued unsuccessfully to get the rights to the Soylent brand trademark.
Speaking of DoorDash, there's a guy in my building who gets that shit delivered every week too. I live with some reprobates.
Somehow you're not the weirdest person around
you. I'm cool. I'm normal.
That's right, folks. In Ohio, this man is considered 100% normal. All right. We're talking about this UFC card going down, headlined by a woman's flyweight bout between Amanda Ribas and Rose Namajunas, sitting on top of a big pile of who cares.
Pretty much.
We were talking about this a little bit before the show that, like, you know, diving into these fights and all that, we always get a little more interested. We always get way more involved than I think either of us plans to.
I don't plan. Let me tell you right now, I don't plan on getting involved or invested in any way.
But yeah, even with the potential that we might, and that Connor is lying to himself, as he often does.
I'm straight too, by the way.
It's what your girlfriend is desperately telling her parents all the time.
Straight as an arrow.
No, I promise.
Go on, come on. Am I distracted?
You think a gay man would let himself live like that? I don't think so.
That's right.
He hasn't combed his hair in months.
So if he's gay, why is he so gross?
That's right.
Checkmate, Dad.
All right. But yeah, even on that potential that we might get more invested, this is a card that really has like a co-main event, and that's it.
Yeah.
It does not have... I mean, Ribas Namajunas should be a main event. They're both talented.
I'm cool with this as a main event.
Yeah, but the problem is that they're both also now in a position where they have sort of seen, well, where Rose seems like she's kind of stopped fighting for anything. Like she's just fighting to get fights, you know? There's no real path to title contention for her right now in any division.
Yeah.
And Ribas is just kind of putting herself in that same position by constantly bouncing between two divisions where it doesn't really seem like she has a foothold in either.
Yeah.
And so it makes this fight feel more like co-main event fodder for what should be a good high profile fight, you know?
I get that.
Like, it's a good fight, but with a win for either woman, what do they come out you know, closer to. Not a lot.
Yeah, I guess I see that.
You know.
I mean, I will take this over another goddamn Rosenstrike fight.
Sure. Day.
Like,
or Tybura Tuivasa.
Yeah, like, even if they are heavyweights who are nominally closer to contention, that contention is ultimately meaningless. Like, do I see, say, Marcin Tybura puts together another two wins and gets a title shot? Do I care? No. He's going to lose to whoever's the champion, because you know when you look at them who is a heavyweight champion caliber fighter and who isn't.
Yes.
And it doesn't look like Marcin Tybura.
No.
So even when they are more relevant for their division, I just care less, and the fights are worse.
Although, to be fair, that fight was super irrelevant, too. More irrelevant than Hibish Namajunas.
Yeah, of course. Not only was somebody... Yes, so. It's just worse across the board, really. Yep. And, like, Rosenstrike isn't fighting for a title, and Gazeev is crap. So, like, that was also utterly irrelevant.
Yeah.
This has some kind of... At least one of these fighters is a former champion.
Exactly, yeah.
You know I mean, that. It's got some heat to it because of that, and
yeah.
It looks like a cool matchup, and they're certainly the most prominent fighters, a pair of fighters on the card, so... the main event is the least of my issues with this card.
Yeah, no, the main event is fine. It just, it all feels like you could make this card feel a lot more solid with just like one big relevant fight above it, you know?
Probably.
Because the prelims are not, they're fight night prelims. It is, I will also, you know, it is... They're at the apex, and they've just stuffed everything on there, so it's nothing interesting, the undercard in general. But there's enough you could pick and spot around that if it had, like, one really cool fight at the top, then having Namajunas Rahibush as the co-main, you'd be like, yeah, okay, you know what? You've done all you need. But,
yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about this Hibush Namajunas matchup, because... yeah, it is. It's not hard for me to see what this fight should look like, but it is kind of hard for me to get a bead on what either woman is kind of like focused on, I guess, you know. Hibush, I will say, at least for her, I think she is determined to try to get to a title shot, and she is trying to be, she's actually not trying to be capital T technical, which, no, or at least she wasn't in her last fight.
She's trying to be capital S scrappy.
Yes, which is good. I want to see, you know, that is what she needs to continue leaning on if she wants to make a run anywhere, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's supposing that she never like improves her boxing technique, which like I think would do a lot for her, because really, the only thing I can see that seriously holds Hibush back is that she is profoundly hittable.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, everywhere else, she's really solid.
Yeah, it's just good to see somebody who's profoundly hittable and might improve their striking someday. Who knows? But we don't, you know, it's to see her lose a few fights and not just be like, oh, I need to be an outfighter so I don't. You know, so I don't get hit more. That's the solution there.
Yeah. Like, no, she likes fighting off the back foot, but not in that way. She's not trying to neutralize. She wants to move around you and like she wants to do like a Joe Calzacchi kind of back foot fighting where she just sprays you with machine gun fire the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And like we saw in her fight against Luana Pinheiro, she just came out and she was on the front foot the whole time.
Yeah, she can do that, like, too, for sure.
Yeah. I'm just going to be aggressive and stay in your face and try to hit you real hard. Mm-hmm. And it's like, great, you know what? That is the kind of aggression you're going to need to maintain, because if you try to make yourself a defensive savant, that is probably, you're just going to be, you're going to get into that Cynthia Calvillo zone of,
mm-hmm.
I'm outfighting without any tools to outfight.
Yeah. Much. Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying about Hibush, like as a developing fighter. Mm-hmm. Like, what is this for? Where is she headed? What's she doing? Like I said, she's a hell of a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, always fun.
I always enjoy watching Hiba fight. And I usually enjoy watching Nami Yunus fight, for that matter.
Like, yeah, Nami Yunus is she's just
exceptions.
She's the more concerning head case because she.
Yeah, I mean, what did you think of her last fight? I thought, I mean, it was coming right after that absolutely dreadful, I mean, all-time bad fight with Esparza.
A year, but yeah.
Right, but it was her very next fight.
It was her next fight, yeah.
So I think probably my initial reaction was very much tempered by me having, like, sub-basement level expectations.
Yeah, I mean, I think she very well might have been able to win it had she not broken her hand.
Yeah, I thought she looked all right.
Yeah, she looked all right. She stayed tough early on, dealing with somebody who was bigger than her and that she just couldn't really feel comfortable getting close to.
Yeah.
And then as the fight went on and Fiora really only offers like two or three things over and over and over that she does, it really felt like Nami Yunus adjusted, found her space in the fight and started to fight really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
you know, looking back at it, I don't totally love a lot of what she was prepared to do. I mean, I think it just feels like the size difference was a massive factor.
Yeah.
Like Rose has basically never been in a striking match where she is just not clearly the longer fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And she usually gets a lot done because of that. But as somebody who I think, I don't know if Rose is, if you could still call Rose prone to getting bullied. But you can definitely see in a lot of her fights, like the Weili Zhangri match or the Fioro one, you can see the moment when she sort of decides she's not going to quit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you can see, going back to the rematch with Andrade, like there's a lot of these fights where the opponent, she's been piecing them up, is often the case, and then they start surging and getting work done and maybe out grappling her, maybe just landing heavy strikes, and you can see her get shaken up. And then sometimes it takes to the end of the round and she has to go to her corner and come back out, but you can see that she routinely decides not to lose.
Yeah.
She has developed over the course of her career that switch. And I was quite impressed to see that she found that in a fight where she was like definitely not winning really at any point.
Mm-hmm.
She was competing the whole time, but her hand was messed up. Her game was not functioning the way she had planned for it to. And still, she came out in round three like trying to go for a finish.
Yeah.
So I took that as a better sign than it might have been. And I gotta say, it's hard for me not to think of Hibish's profound hitability, which we've already mentioned several times, as being a really serious liability against somebody like Rose.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to go back that far to find Amanda Hibish losing to Caitlin Chukagian or Sermonara Ni Chukagian.
Right.
And just, yeah, Hibish has always, like, this is why I say I'm glad she's staying aggressive, because she thrives at her best when she is able to charge into somebody with power,
mm-hmm.
and hit that really nice body lock trip that she does, that she can get everybody down at least once,
mm-hmm.
with that. And it, like, her game is best geared when she is being aggressive and when she can be at the edge of striking range, pushing forward and like throwing a wheel kick or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But so I like that for her, but it is something that Nami Yunus is very adept at dealing with if she's not just, you know, if she's not faced with a problem like Mano Fiorot, who's going to sit at the edge of range and just pick at her, where, you know, suddenly the range and the power are a huge problem, or Fiorot can clinch up and bully Nami Yunus mm-hmm. inside and take away any infighting and all that. Hibish, like, she can fall into the clinch, but she's not gonna, there's nothing where she can maintain. You know, there's no point for Amanda Hibish where it's just like, oh, she can just maintain a clean fight that no. is going to be difficult for Rose.
Because in order to land anything, which she likes to do, she's very yeah. scrappy, she has to come in and she doesn't really understand how to do that without being square.
Yeah.
And she sort of just telegraphs by default as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even on her jabs, she tends to like load up and tense a moment and then like step into range and then jab.
Yep.
And she tends to pop her chin up in the air when she does it. So, you know, like she's just hittable at all points. And Rose is an excellent straight puncher.
Yep.
So, and while I don't yet have an idea of how powerful she could be for this division, she was a pretty powerful strawweight, Rose.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that is probably the final hurdle that keeps her from ever being a real contender in this division.
Yeah, although she's going to have to become a much better combination puncher if she's not going to have the same power.
Yeah. And maybe she'll get a title shot. You know, it might only take like beating Chukayin and sure. I don't know, Jennifer Maya or something to be like, oh, well, Nami Yunus is the default option right now.
I mean, I'd love to see if there were no hurdles in the way and they were just like, hey, we're doing Nami Yunus versus Grasso.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. That sounds fun.
Yeah, it'd be a fun fight. But it does definitely, like, I think she's going to not have that power in her pocket to lean on in this weight class.
Yeah. Like I said, she's going to have to retool her game a bit. She's going to have yeah. to become a more consistent combination puncher. And probably just try less to hit with power and just touch people with quick shots.
Mm-hmm.
But she does have speed.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, based on my eyeballing, notably faster than somebody like Chukagian.
Yeah.
Who was also just sort of able to touch Hibish at will.
Yep.
So really, the question for me in this fight is simply, can Hibish, can she swamp Rose with wrestling?
That seems very unlikely to me.
I mean, it's a path to win, and it is a way that people have worn on Rose. Hibish is a very good top position grappler and not the greatest wrestler, but she does have decent enough timing. And as you said, she tends to hit everybody at least once.
Yeah. She almost always gets one body lock takedown per fight. Yep.
That running body lock kind of knee trip takedown she likes.
Mm-hmm.
But if she can't do that, I have to go with Nami Yunus, who I think is going to touch her up. I think is also going to be, because of her discomfort with range, Hibish also tends to reach. And Rose is actually pretty damn good with like one-off clinch knees.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's going to be able to run Hibish into a lot of strikes. I also kind of have the feeling that this might be a fight where Rose, as she has been in more of her recent fights, is determined to come forward. And that Hibish will let her. And I think Rose likes walking people down. Because, again, yeah. I think she is a bully, which is why she has that visible insecurity when somebody turns fights around on her. So I have to pick Rose Nami Yunus. I just think she's capable of outstriking Hibish.
Yep, I agree. It's a good fight for Rose. It should be right in her wheelhouse in terms of style clashes that she's used to dealing with.
She also didn't come close to gassing against Fiorot, which is another problem she's had and could be a good thing about her having moved up to 125.
Yeah. I always like to see strikers move up, honestly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It almost always ends up being if not a positive for their career, like letting them be the exact same fighter that they were down a division.
She wisely waited for Shevchenko to die.
Yep. Yeah.
Because Shevchenko would have ragdolled her even now.
Yep.
Just by being way stronger. And now she can go up there and outstrike a bunch of awkward slow people.
Yep. So yeah, should be a solid performance for Nami Yunus. For Hibash, like, as long as she can find bursts and blitzes, she can probably keep this at least entertaining. Mm-hmm. If Nami Yunus isn't going to have so much power to easily hurt her up there.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel like she's going to run into exactly the kinds of problems that she's run into several times with fighters like Marina Rodriguez and Caitlin Chukagian, which is just that there's no version of offense that Hibash does, even her best offense, that involves her not getting hit.
Yep.
And that is not true of Rose Nami Yunus.
Mm-hmm.
Now that Tapology just did a retool, so we're, for the first time, just going to kind of keep things in the Tapology family. They're a great site. I'm happy to...
That's right. They finally got old man Zane on board.
It's true.
He also just signed up for his first Facebook account. He's been hearing a lot of great things about it.
Yep. I was trying to... I kept having to have my niece and nephew mail me photos of themselves. Soon I'm going to get rid of my flip phone.
You've been saying that for years.
Look, those Nokias just last so long.
My nieces and nephews.
All right. Odds on the fight, using the Tapology odds, which I'm not sure where they're collecting and aggregating from, but whatever. We're just always using, you know, I always want an aggregate anyway, generally.
Just give me a number and I'll read it without thinking about it.
That's right. Hibash is currently at plus 150 as the underdog, and Nami Yunus at minus 185 is the favorite. Wow, that really came out well.
Rebus. We only just said her name 8,000 times.
Yeah.
It's like you have a reading part of your brain and a speaking part of your brain. I think that's what the issue is. You can say it conversation and then you read it and you're not.
Yes.
So not saying the same word you were just saying.
That is, I think, what it is. Did realize a small fault in this. I do like looking at the changes in the odds over time, mm-hmm. which we can't get off the Tapology.
Well, go back to using the thing you were using. I mean, no one cares.
It's true. Let's see. I just liked having everything in one tab.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's a sweet deal. Hibash opened at plus 142, is currently at plus 183, and Nami Yunus opened at minus 150, currently minus 207. So odds are getting longer on Nami Yunus, which makes sense to me. Like, this is just a really good matchup for her, it feels like. All right, that brings us to our co-main, the first prelim, the rest of the card, Carl Williams, Justin Taffa, and Carl Williams is going to win.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the very, say what you will, it's heavyweights. First of all, not the main event. Thank you, Jesus.
Yeah.
Second of all, Carl Williams is an actual heavyweight prospect.
Yeah.
This is a big athletic man who can box a little bit and can wrestle quite well.
Yep.
So, like, I'll take that at heavyweight. We need more of that.
Mm-hmm. Justin Taffa is just, I mean, you know, he's part of the army of Mark Hunt clones that we've talked about, where, like, they just all seem to have gotten the be big and punch hard part down. And not the have a nuanced boxing game part down. Taffa at least he's actually probably a little more nuanced than Tuivasa, but he's also a lot less dynamic and fast on his feet and big and able to change speeds and things like that. he's a little trickier with how he'll set his punches up, but it is really just that punching layer is kind of it. There's no other.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like most heavyweights, you can do exactly one thing.
Yeah. And it's not stick with the diet.
No. You know what? I think we should give him a little, you know, we should lay off him about that. Dieting is hard. Not everybody has the time, you know?
Yeah, fair.
Some people are so stressed out about, for example, being in the closet that they just can't.
I was really sure you were going to say in Cincinnati, but.
Same difference, really.
That's right.
Yeah. I just didn't really feel like my real self till I moved to Indianapolis. No, Indianapolis is a nightmare. Yeah, I have nothing to add.
Yeah.
Other than more jokes. Like I said, Carl Williams has a jab. He can move his feet reasonably well. He's pretty agile for a heavyweight, and he can hit a really hard, well-timed shot. So, yeah. Honestly, like, you compare him to, like, did you see they just made Waldo Cortez Acosta versus, what's the guy's name? Dominguez Bingus or something? What's his name? Robelis
Despain.
That to me is like, that's what they think heavyweight prospects are. This is what I want. Carl Williams is what I want. This is a real heavyweight prospect, a guy with a skill set and athleticism.
Yeah.
I kind of like him.
You're saying Dominguez Bedingus does not have a skill set?
I've been told he does. I've yet to see it. His skill set is being 6'9".
Yeah. Williams is currently a minus 225, Taffa at plus 185. Those odds have been getting a bit closer together, though. Some books had Williams opening as high as minus 265. So,
why would they get closer, though?
I don't know.
Don't bet on Justin Taffa here, folks.
Yeah.
Not saying it's impossible. It's heavyweight. Knockout is one way to win, but that's not a good bet.
No, especially not. Like, the only way Williams has ever lost is by triangle choke to that one guy who only wins by triangle choke.
Yep.
Which, as you see, a guy who is purely a, like, shot wrestling takedown artist, him losing by triangle choke is zero surprise. That is the ideal prospect loss for somebody like him to have.
Yeah.
And he had
Go on.
He had an amateur loss by armbar as well, which, once again, if I'm looking at a power wrestling prospect, these are the losses I want to see them have.
Yeah. Well, having said that, now I look at Justin Toffa's stats. 100% takedown defense, Zane.
Oh, wow.
It's over.
It is over.
Because I know he has been tested against some real wrestlers.
Yeah.
Such as... And... And let's not forget,
Harry Hunsucker has a super prototypical Midwest build. Surely he must be a wrestler.
He looks like he was raised on corn and hormones. He must be able to wrestle. Nope.
All right. That brings us to a middleweight bout. Edmund Shabazian, AJ Dobson. And, this feels a lot to me like exactly the kind of fight that Shabazian should be able to win, that has people then putting him in much more difficult fights that he cannot win.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Shabazian is, I do a lot of griping about coaches, like certain coaches, like basically scamming their fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And,
coaches who talk a lot about head movement.
is Shabazian still with Edmund?
No, I don't think he is. Yeah, I believe he figured out a little while ago that was probably not the best way to spend his formative training years.
Well, I'm going to give Edmund a pass on this one. I don't. Sure. I do not think it is his fault. Like, if you're going to attribute anything in Shabazzian's game to Edmund Tavernier, like, you got to be honest, the dude's a pretty good boxer.
Yeah, he did get a really solid grounding in fundamentals.
Yeah, he honestly has a very solid boxing game. Great jab, hits the body diligently. Excellent combinations. He actually has some head movement.
Yeah.
His problem is something it will take a really, really good coach to address, but I don't think it can be blamed on even a quite poor coach.
Sure.
It is a psychological hangup.
Yeah, it is. I do wonder if it is like, you know, he was not, he picked up some decent tricks with that Glendale fighting systems and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But you go and look at his early record and he was absolutely just like can crushing as well.
Yeah.
And I do wonder how much there was a gym culture of just like protecting people relentlessly.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like in the gym, he's just like probably what Shabazzian needed, like a really, and again, I'm truly not blaming Edmund for this.
I think
Shabazzian's got his issues. But to avoid reinforcing those issues, maybe as a coach, you would do something like, all right, Edmund, it's your training camp. We're going to start you off sparring 10 different guys, two rounds apiece.
Yeah.
You got to spar them all. And they're not going to be trying to beat you up too bad, but you got to keep going. And they're going to be fresh every round.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of stuff he needs to break him of. Because clearly what it is it's not that Edmund Shabazzian gets more tired than other fighters.
No, absolutely. I the dude looks like he's well conditioned and in good shape all the time.
I'm sure his strength and conditioning is on point. He's clearly a good athlete. It's like, look at that Dustin Poirier fight with Benoit Saint-Denis.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Poirier got tired.
Yeah.
But that happens. But that happens.
Yep.
You're gonna get tired. Shabazzian's issue is he hates when he gets tired. He has never developed the ability to recognize that he can still fight effectively tired.
Yeah. It's also a thing where his wrestling and grappling games more particularly, but also his boxing game.
He's got no throttle.
He's got no throttle, and they are well practiced with the things that he was taught.
Yeah.
But not deep. Not tactically deep,
not strategic. He's making a lot of doing a lot of cool moves, but not making decisions. He's a lot of thought put into how to prolong himself and ensure his best chances to win, and not just go for all of the textbook moves.
Yeah, because it's a very like, oh, you know, he's stuffed. A fight will start out and be like, oh, he's stuffing shots. He's countering wrestling. You know, he's out there flicking his jab, changing his targets, looks great. And then if the opponent can find a way to force a fight on him where he stops having a little success, if they can clinch him up and start pulling him to the mat where he has to scramble up,
mm-hmm.
then not only do his technical skills start not only do his decisions start to break down a little, but his game just gets shallower and shallower afterward, where he starts to just get caught up, trapped doing the same couple of things where he only has like one or two, he'll only show one or two answer when he's fighting from behind.
Yeah.
Parts from his game get notably removed.
Yeah. But I think at that point, he's in full on panic mode.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, it is.
This is the other thing. Because like I said, it's not just getting tired. It is.
Yeah.
Everybody gets tired. And like, you know, like how many times people talk about Dominic Cruz? I think he's gassing.
Yeah. Yeah, Dominic Cruz fought with his mouth open for half of every fight he was in.
Half of every fight. And you just see him taking these big, deep breaths and settling himself. And he just keeps working.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, getting tired is – you have to get tired before you reach the point where you have that kind of cardio that being a human being basically lasts forever.
Yeah.
This is genuinely a thing. I don't think Edmund Shahbazyan is an atypical person.
No.
And human beings have amazing stamina as a rule.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the only physical gift we have that puts us above every other animal species. That's the only thing we have. We're smart and we can run forever.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Shahbazyan, for whatever reason, it does feel like he must have just been cooking people in the gym.
Yeah, I think that it is. I think that's a big part of it. Whether, you know, it may be just it was always in him to be to only be able to be the hammer. It might be just a base personality trait for him.
Yeah.
But I also just get the feeling that, like, because Ronda Rousey had the same thing, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, these people were not training to know how to be the nail.
Yeah. So maybe it is Edmund's fault.
Yeah, good. I think it might be the training.
He reinforced some very bad habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what it feels like Edmund Shahbazyan needs, like what he would really benefit from, honestly, is just having fights in the gym.
Yeah, like he
I know the culture is that hard sparring is actually bad, and like Robbie Lawler stopped doing it, and Max Holloway stopped doing it, but like preparing yourself for the stress of a fight does require a little fighting.
Well, and Holloway and Lawler were also just like. I want to say Lawler was unbreakable, but like when Lawler would get broken in a fight, it would just be that he's frustrated that this loser doesn't want to have a real fight like him.
Yes. Yeah.
That was his version of getting broken.
Both of those guys were also super experienced and comfortable in long fights by the time they decided they didn't really need to do a lot of hard sparring anymore. Yeah.
Otherwise,
hard sparring has its uses.
You see Lawler in like the most brutal war you can think of, and he's at his happiest, you know?
Yeah.
There's no level of hard that a fight could be that got guys like Holloway or Lawler to be like, oh, I don't want to do this.
But I'm sure both of them have been through more than their fair share of gym wars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To get to that point, right?
Yeah. Something like King's MMA.
Absolutely.
If you're talking about like a California camp for this guy, now he's in. He's at least at Extreme Couture, which is probably like one of the best ideas just for where he's at now, because it's, you know, it's more of a like find your waterfall. Let's like tactically work with whatever you've brought us kind of camp. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you can't help but feeling somebody like Cordero, who's just like, no, you're going to go out there and you're going to learn to be aggressive all the time. And you're going to get the fight taken to you. And that's fine. You're going to have the gym war. Would have been good
for aggressive all the time. Cordero's trained some solid like outside fighters too. Like,
yeah,
he is, because his success is really a testament to the putting fighters through their paces part of training.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't think anybody goes to Kings who doesn't have to experience just sheer misery sometimes in the gym. So anyway, all of this is because Edmund Shahbazyan is obviously the really interesting side of this fight.
Yeah.
AJ Dobson is a fighter with, I would say, mostly as yet unrealized potential.
Yep.
Like he has the very bare bones of a kind of a cool southpaw counterpunching game.
Mm-hmm. He knows how to throw straight, and he's got the size and the speed and the power to make it count.
But he's really one and done. He just doesn't have that many ideas.
Yeah.
Of what he wants to do, and his version of counterpunching does tend to involve an awful lot of waiting.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it.
Uh-huh. And then at least it's against Tafon and Chukwi, he showed he's willing to wrestle. I mean, who knows? If that turns out to be something that he can make happen as this fight wears on, it could actually lead to him winning.
But even that was mostly like he caught a kick and took Chukwi down and got on top of him.
Yeah.
He can wrestle, but no part of his game has been deep. And like, you know, it's hard not to come back to like that Jacob Malkoon fight, where it was like Malkoon really struggled to get a double leg on Dobson in the opening round, and then found one single leg.
Yep.
And for the whole rest of the fight, just wrecked Dobson's day.
Yep.
There's just not depth to any part of Dobson's game to the point that I just don't feel like he's going to put Shabazzian in a place where Shabazzian has to dig into those layers that start to make him feel panicked.
Yeah. One thing I will say, there is no such thing as an Edmund Shabazzian lock.
No.
He is capable of destroying himself. This is the doesn't have a throttle part.
Yeah.
He did look pretty decent in that fight with Dalcha Lunjambula, another one against a big powerful guy who was nonetheless unable to press him.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my feeling. But yeah.
And he extended himself pretty well.
And I also thought, I will say, he comported himself really well against Anthony Hernandez.
I thought so too. I thought that showed some of the growth of what he'd been working on. It was just like at a certain point, it was like reliving a nightmare for him.
Yeah, that was just a fight. Like from a mile out, anybody could have called. Like, no, you can't put somebody mentally breakable in with the most hard-nosed, will scramble you to death fighter in his division. He's not going to come out with a win. It's not going to happen. But I thought he fought really well all through the second round to the point that like he eventually got broken late, but it was a hard, like Anthony Hernandez had to really put it on him.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the Nasruddin Imavov loss or the Jack Hermanson loss.
Yeah.
Or the Derek Brunson loss where it's like, oh yeah, he's there for a round and he looks great. And then something starts to go against him and he's gone.
Like, that's true. Yeah. That is a sign of growth. I mean, it just may be that it's a slow road for Shabazzian.
Yeah.
It does seem like he's been working on some of these issues.
He switched camps. He figured it out.
Extreme Couture. 26. I mean,
yeah. Extreme Couture will put him through gym wars. There's no question about that. At
least he's in Vegas. What he needs to go is to go to like some grimy boxing gym and get his ass kicked.
Yeah.
A bunch.
Sean Strickland will at least, try to replicate that.
Yeah. Oh, are you getting tired, pussy?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then start crying relentlessly after he's done insulting Shabazzian.
He is really. He's really just gotten worse, hasn't he?
He is fully like. All the success part has happened for him. And so now it really, like, that chip on his shoulder is gone. So now it's really just being left with the manic depressive thing that I think has probably been undiagnosed and hidden for a long time because he just got to be, like, the angry guy who didn't have, who hadn't gotten his fair shake. And now he's gotten his fair shake.
I gotta say, it's sort of a classic thing with people of a more conservative mindset. Like, I got exactly what I wanted, but people still don't like me, and now I'm mad about that.
Yeah, but I think
it's like I got what I wanted. I achieved this success.
But he even got people liking him.
Fair. But even that, it's just not enough. Everybody doesn't like him, and the judges are unfair to him, and
His political views have caused
him to fight a terrible fight that he definitely deserved to lose. Like,
I think there's some real manic depression though that is just like surfacing.
For sure, I think that's absolutely part of it. Yeah,
it's
a dog who caught the mail truck, and now he's like, "Why the fuck was I chasing this?"
Exactly, and it's now the manic upswings are. They're still there. You hear things like, Chris Curtis is talking about like, oh, Sean, Sean Strickland lost. And the next day he's out on the ski slope. I'm like, yeah, let's go, dude. Let's do something. It's like, yeah, okay. So he's on a manic upswing. He doesn't, automatically wallow. But then, he's talking about now like waking up one day and just being like, I just want to burn everything down. I was like, yes, we are clearly getting a display of somebody now just who pings between emotional highs and lows, regardless of the environment around them.
I think it's a thing a lot of fighters go through, to be honest. Some are just better at coping and are quieter as people.
I had this thought the other day. And
Folks wrote an excellent thing, by the way. He talked to Dustin Poirier about routine cycle of post-fight depression.
Yeah.
Even when he wins.
I had a thought the other day that I think is very true, and I'm going to say it, and somebody might out there might get mad at me, but who knows? If you're listening to this show at this point still,
yeah,
and you're either already infinitely mad at me all the time, or you've accepted a cult of personality that you actually think I have interesting things
you're
to say.
You're a slave to our wills. Exactly. Yeah, no, those people do exist, though, that just hate.
Yes, they do. I have heard from them.
Just listening.
But I would say Sean Strickland is closer to George St. Pierre than any of us. Like, I bet George St. Pierre is most fighters, even the like most cool, calm, normalish ones that you can think of, are a lot closer to Sean Strickland than they are to you or I.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, for sure.
Like
in terms of what the emotional experience of being a fighter is like.
The emotional and the pathos that they're carrying and the thin skinnedness and just the like raw emotional output. Some of them put a lot better varnish on it, but
GSP and Dustin Poirier are of a class where it's definitely there.
Yeah.
You can feel the seething rage and resentment sometimes, but they really hide it.
Exactly.
Quite well.
So they keep
those thoughts inside.
Strickland I appreciate him in a way because he is giving everybody a real mask off look at how a lot of fighters live and what they think. Mm-hmm. And why they are so fragile and angry at people over like the littlest thing.
It is a life of ups and downs and a lot of pressure, you know?
And usually it comes from people who have experienced a ton of trauma in their life and are not really have not really worked through it in very healthy ways.
George getting a call from his mom after the Johnny Hendricks fight.
George, you have been in the hot tub for 3 weeks now. God, Mom, I just want to hot tub with my friends.
I want to burn down the world.
I wish an alien would take me away.
Yeah.
Take me away from all this.
Anyway. George. I don't think Dobson has the tools to stretch Shabazian's game.
Seem like it. It seems like a fight where if Shabazian loses, it will be of his own doing. And that does seem less a thing than it was.
Yeah, I'm still going to be looking at pace and pressure fighters and really good wrestlers.
Yeah.
To be Shabazian's kryptonite, like Hernandez, Imavov, Hermanson, Brunson. These guys are all really good, and they are either capable of putting a lot of pressure on somebody or fighting a really consistent battle that Shabazian isn't necessarily going to win anyway. Like somebody like Imavov, he's got the length and the form to keep Shabazian uncomfortable at his preferred range.
Yeah.
And then the size that, you know, Shabazian, when he would try like start tying up with the Imavov and things like that, he would start getting dragged into a fight that he could not keep up with.
Yep.
But Dobson, I just don't see that guy. No. He seems a lot like Shabazian, in fact. And I think Shabazian can probably beat himself.
But less crafty, less...
Yes, less crafty, less sophisticated. And that just seems like a recipe for Shabazian to cruise.
Mm-hmm.
Odds on the fight. Shabazian opened at minus 181, is currently minus 194. Dobson opened at plus 161, is currently plus 172. Could be wider to me, honestly. I know Shabazian's lost a lot, but I just don't. I don't think this fight makes sense, honestly. You know, I don't think Dobson has a lot to offer to really test what's wrong with Shabazzian.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree.
All right, that brings us to a bantamweight fight. Peyton Talbot, Cameron Simon, and kind of two of the same kind of prospect, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Both guys who very inherently understand what the meta of martial arts, of MMA is right now.
And that meta is doing stuff.
Yes. Pace and pressure. Keep on somebody, throw lots of stuff, make lots of things happen, trust that you will win out in the pocket or in the scramble just because you're doing more. They are that kind of dude.
Mm-hmm.
Simon might be a little more checked, a little more clued in on that. Talbot is a fighter who I think just is very much in the nothing wrong can happen to me as long as I keep pouring it on.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of way. And like it was notable in that fight he had with Nick Aguirre, how easily Aguirre could get into positions where Talbot just couldn't fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Because Talbot had run himself all the way through whatever advantage he might have had. Now, at the same time, Talbot was able to fight hard out of it to the point that he just gassed Aguirre and started winning.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Simon is just a little more measured with that. Not a lot, but a little. Just a little bit more willing to be like, I'm going to sit at the edge of range and throw a bunch of stuff, some of which will collapse the pocket, way too much spinning stuff, but more willing to kind of mind what he thinks is the fight he should be having.
Well, I just don't think Talbot's going to, because really what happened against, is it Aguirre? I can't trust you. It's some pronunciation that is not what it looks like, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I'm just going to say Aguirre. That's the name as I know it. But
okay.
Aguirre, Wrath of God, which the fact that Wrath of God is not his nickname just goes to show what kind of people we're dealing with here. That's an awesome nickname. It's right there.
Yeah. No, he's Slick Nick.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Nick, the Wrath of God, Aguirre. It is right. It is perfect.
Yeah. Doesn't feel all that fitting, as I'm watching this fight with Talbot back again.
No. He doesn't have that in him, but... Stern talking to of God.
the very disappointed God.
Yes.
Because what really happened in that fight is that he was able to out-wrestle Talbot because Talbot literally just walks into range.
Yeah.
Doesn't jab, doesn't feint, just it tries to be imposing and is happy to throw strikes when he gets there. But aside from the takedowns, there was no punishment for Talbot walking into range.
No.
And he's not going to be able to do that for free against Cameron Simon. Cameron Simon fights at a very fast pace,
mm-hmm.
and has a really, really diverse array of strikes at his disposal.
Yep.
I honestly was really impressed with Cameron Simon against Christian Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I hold Christian Rodriguez in very high esteem, and we'll get to talk about that in our bonus today.
Mm-hmm.
But Cameron Simon, in a fight that he was definitely losing because he was just technically outclassed, was able to make it super close and difficult the entire time just because he keeps throwing no matter what. You don't get to just get free shots off on him. And he will just pull something else out of the grab bag each time he throws.
Yeah. I watch Cameron Simon, and it is very obvious to me what his camp, that camp, the Dricus du Plessis camp, is doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he's like a more coordinated but significantly less imposing Dricus.
Yes.
But the result is you just have to deal with a whole lot of variety. And I just don't think Peyton Talbot has any defense at all.
Yeah, but Simon doesn't really either. That's the other thing.
Well, Simon has footwork at least. He's got some footwork.
He is a little bit more mindful of pace and position, or of positioning, but he is also a guy who will just, through sheer desire to create constantly, put himself in all sorts of positions that get him hit really hard.
Yeah, absolutely, no doubt about that.
You know, he scraped by Manny Martinez.
Yeah.
Which is just like a well-timed right hand with a massive head attached.
And he's perhaps not as powerful as Peyton Talbot.
The thing is, I'm going to pick Peyton Talbot here. If he loses, I will not feel a moment's surprise over that. But I keep coming back to the idea for me that Cameron Simon, he is fighting like Dricus without any of the athleticism. And that is actually a bigger concern than Talbot's lack of defense. That, like, being the unathletic guy who is just always right there, trying, letting the opponent have an opportunity against better athletes. Even like Christian Rodriguez just looked like a better athlete, you know? So I might be wrong on it, but.
Yeah, I just think that, I get that. Like, Simon is, like, we talked about Amanda Hibosh's striking. Same shit with Cameron Simon. Like, whenever he engages, you can hit him.
Yeah.
He's
more mindful of his position, but whenever he does anything, he gets hit really hard.
But he's trickier than Peyton Talbot.
Definitely trickier, unquestionably.
He feints, he cuts angles. He throws combinations more than Talbot does. He will also wrestle.
Yeah.
You know, he went for a lot of really nice takedown entries against Christian Rodriguez. Rodriguez is just a very good defensive wrestler. That was a huge opportunity for Nick Aguirre, and he just couldn't maintain it. But the takedowns were there the entire fight.
Yeah.
I just think there's too much to worry about. I just think Peyton Talbot is really one note. I see what you're saying, but I mean, he literally just walks into range.
He does. And I won't be surprised at all if he loses, but I just think that Simon will engage him at that range. He will be happy to get the kind of pace fight that he's used to. And it is a fight that Simon, to date, honestly, even in his victories, is like barely scraping through every time.
Yeah, I do see the athleticism and power difference here, and that very well could be decisive. But supposing that Simon's chin holds up, I think he's got a good shot of frustrating and annoying
I think Simon will be far less dedicated to just clinging on the way Aguirre was.
Oh yeah, if he gets takedowns, he's gonna
try to do stuff that I think Talbot is actually pretty well geared to scramble out of.
That's a good point.
You know, Aguirre was a seatbelt and a backpack, and that was it. You know.
Yeah.
And I think Simon, you know,
he wants to do cool stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of Dricus there. There's a lot of, like, I am going to run into you, and I'm going to be doing something diverse and creative and changing it up every time, and I'm going to be indefatigable in doing that.
Yeah.
But it will not, like, I'm not going to, like, hold you somewhere or just, like, oh, I got to a position, I'm going to dominate you now. It's just... No, I'm going to reinitiate the car crash every time. So,
yeah,
I just kind of think in general that Simon is he exposes the undercurrent of what the Dricus du Plessis system is, and I think over time it'll look like all the flaws inherent in that system as well.
I co-sign that. I'm just not sure about this fight.
That's fair. Yeah. I think Talbot is a fighter, to me, who is much more likely to shake out as a really top-end prospect at some point.
He's clearly got more physical potential.
Yeah, and he just has the absolute unchecked aggression that you want to see out of somebody with that kind of physical potential.
Mm-hmm.
So,
doubtless this will be a fun fight.
It'll be unquestionably a fun
fight. This is an action matchup for sure.
Talbot is the slight favorite, opened at minus 114, is currently at minus 134. Simon opened at minus 111, is currently at plus 120. Yeah, I have seen some people out there on the internet being like, oh man, Simon, he's going to wreck, you know, Talbot's not ready and all that. I just want to be like every time, like, Simon is not an athlete. It is one of the things that journalists who aren't analysts, which there are, which is most of them, a trap they fall into relentlessly over and over, because they tend to get to know a lot of fighters really well, is that, like, they will be hype machines for guys that just absolutely do not have a prayer of being good long term.
Yeah.
Relentlessly. They get really trapped into the, I see how hard this guy works. I talk to him. I see how much fun he is in the cage. And so I believe that they will be great, and that, like, you know, their opponent just isn't ready for the kind of fighter that, and it's like, no, you gotta understand a lot of, there are a lot of baseline athletic just sort of unfairness that goes into this as well.
Yeah. I have a sort of perverted version of that where I'm like, I see this guy with zero discernible personality who throws jabs real good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm like, surely that will override all of his physical disadvantages.
Yeah.
This guy's cool, isn't he, guys? Guys?
I'm on the other end of, like, I see this guy who has some baseline athletic tools. I'm just going to assume that his terrible technical flaws will be overcome or will be accounted for and not, like, a major liability because the physical gifts are there.
And your record is better than mine. It has to be said.
All right. Billy Quarantillo, Yusuf Zalal, and
Zalal's back.
Yeah, he got a short notice call up when Gabriel Miranda stepped out of this fight. Which,
Gabriel Miranda, do I know him?
He is the grappler guy with the weird mustache who has been who got wrecked by Benoit Saint-Denis, but then came back and absolutely choked out Shane Young and really put proof to the idea that Young is just done.
Yeah, I do love Yusuf Zalal had a total Chris Camozzi interim.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This happens so often. Zalal is such a quadruple A fighter.
He is the definition of a quadruple A talent.
Because he's so clearly good. He's not a bad fighter. He's well schooled. He doesn't have a particularly deep game in any phase, but he is very well rounded.
Yep.
And tough. He's smart. He's tough and he's smart. You know, like he knows how to mix up his tools. He knows how to bank rounds. He comes into fights with a good idea of how he's going to, like, neutralize his opponent. And then he just got smushed by, like, some random smattering of weird guys. One of whom, to be fair, was Ilya Topuria. And he actually did a lot better against Topuria than anyone else after, because it was still a very raw version of Ilya.
Mm-hmm. He's just not dangerous anywhere. He's not dangerous. At all.
Yeah.
And that is the big thing.
He's not dangerous, and he's not principled enough in any one phase to make up for that. Like, Zalal could get away with being exactly as powerful and as strong. I mean, he's fast enough.
Yeah.
You know, if this guy could, like, pop out the jab and take angles on people and dart in with quick combinations. But he wants to do like MMA stuff. So he's going to jab and barrel into a clinch.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like there's just not enough layers that he can and enough depth he can work off of to kind of. Because ideally with a well-rounded fighter, what that means is you can trap somebody in the phase against which they are weakest.
Yep.
And Zalal, he's sort of a prisoner of his own game sometimes, that he's not actually strong enough in any of those phases to not have to do all of them against everybody.
Yeah.
And so despite his well-roundedness, the lack of physicality continues to be a problem every time, because he is, no matter what, he's going to jump into some phase where you being much bigger or much stronger or much harder hitting than him is going to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But it is funny that he got, yeah, like three losses and then the draw to Damon Blackshear, and then he gets cut from the UFC and he just wrecks three dudes in a row.
Yep. And he even took a boxing and kickboxing bout where he wrecked dudes too. So
yeah,
five fights where he just went out and won right away.
Yeah. Yeah. Only the boxing one, unsurprisingly, was not a first round finish. It probably wasn't even a good boxer, but
yeah, none of the fighters were actually good. I will say that. I went and watched those fights.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Those were guys who were all, they were all in shape. And so they, you know, were had some like decency that way, but they were also fighters who the first time they get hit hard, just fold.
Yeah. Even if it's Yusuf Zalal's version of hitting hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, great indication of like what a mediocre UFC fighter can actually do to like your average regional fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Or any like mediocre fighter who makes it and has competitive fights on a world stage like that.
Yeah. No, there is no joke when like people talk about how there'll be some guy who's like, you know, 10-6 at their gym and has never made it to the UFC and has been just like fighting around like Titan or something like that, who will absolutely wreck any person else in the gym on any day of the week that they want. Absolutely. All the time.
Yeah. There's both a very long way to go and a lot of parity all the way down.
Yeah.
Anyway, all that being said, this is not a very good matchup for Yusuf Zalal.
No.
In the sense that he is a fighter who,
he'll have a good first round. Is that?
He might not even have that great
first not,
round, yeah, because he will concede pressure to Billy Quarantillo.
Yeah.
So if Quarantillo starts really slow and isn't even like pressing him, then yes, Zalal is gonna, he might hit a cool takedown. He's gonna land some nice jabs. Gonna land some body kicks. Mm-hmm. He's gonna dance around. The moment Quarantillo, which typically these days he does right from the jump, the moment he starts pressuring Zalal and forcing him to skirt along the fence, it is just going to be downhill for Yusuf.
Yeah.
That is simply the way Quarantillo fights go, and it is the way a couple of Zalal's losses have gone too.
Yep.
So, yeah, I just think he's going to have a lot of trouble getting off the fence. I think he's going to have a lot of trouble consistently out-wrestling Quarantillo as the fight goes on. And Quarantillo, this is superpower that he knows how he wins fights.
Yep.
He does not get discouraged by anything that happens in the first half of the fight or more.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all part of the process of making you fight him until you start to crumble. So, yep, got to pick Quarantillo.
Yeah, especially with short notice too, where like if If Zalal is not like in perfect shape for this fight, then Quarantillo can start to drag him into something where maybe he starts to get tired, and that's just going to be a, you know.
Yep.
A misery. Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that. Really, you know, Quarantillo, yeah, the striking is still very bad against any kind of persistent range attack, which is why I think there's a chance for Zalal to have a good first round if he can just get out there and put a jab and some kicks out there on Quarantillo.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's hard not to see Quarantillo being able to push for the clinch and get it. And even if he doesn't have a lot of success wrestling Zalal right away, just being able to make this fight messy and keep it messy and not getting hurt that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's the kind of thing that lets Quarantillo continue creating the fight that he eventually wins.
Yeah.
That's all he wants to do is just like, let's get connected. Let me get in your face. Let me throw a bunch of overhands that might clip you. And sooner or later, you're going to get tired of having a messy fight. And the moment you get tired of having that fight, even if you're not tired yourself, you just start to get frustrated. Quarantillo starts to win. You know?
Yep.
So. Odds on the fight. Quarantillo opened at minus 141, currently at minus 127. Zalal opened at plus 127, currently at plus 115. So close odds. People are not willing to give up on Zalal here or go all in on Quarantillo. I mean, I get it. Quarantillo is a fighter who any kind, especially like, the thing we've seen is if you are a consistent striker with power, Quarantillo does not really have a way to deal with you.
Yeah.
Because his wrestling game is not good and or is not like technical, and his striking game is always raw. So if you can just hit him hard all the time and win takedown battles where you can return to your feet and not get swarmed by him, then Quarantillo does not really have a avenue to turning the momentum against you. But as we kind of laid out, Zalal is a guy who doesn't have a lot of power and tends to have to do everything. And the fights he won on the regionals, they all involved him like immediately rushing and crushing guys and getting on top of them and punishing them physically in a way that I just don't think he's going to be able to do in the UFC and was never really able to do in the UFC before.
Yeah.
All right. That brings us to our final fight on the main card. Luis Pauelo against Fernando Padilla. And, Padilla just has, he has a really selectively functional game that is basically, if you don't know how to fight long, Padilla can make you look really bad. Or if you don't know how to be, or if you can't be physical with him, because he does have a loss to Spike Carlisle as well. So I don't want to just say it's just the fighting long, but it's, if you don't know, if you can't physically bully him inside, and if you don't know how to fight long, then Padilla can make you look really bad.
Mm-hmm.
He is really at his best as a pocket counterpuncher who is frustrating you by getting you on the end of his jab and kick so that you have to blitz in. In some ways, he's kind of a lot like Julian Arosa, who he beat, except not as chinny as Arosa.
Mm-hmm.
And Pauelo, he doesn't really have enough relevant experience,
yeah,
for me to feel like ultra comfortable about what he can and can't do. But he mostly seems like he's there to be an action brawler who goes forward and meets people with power and mm-hmm. just kind of gets them scared. And I feel like that just plays perfectly into the things that Padilla does well. I don't think Pauelo is such an athlete or physical force that he's going to be able to overwhelm Padilla just off of his physicality. And there's none of the consistency that Kyle Nelson was able to show, where he was able to just go out there and match the jab and the low kick of Padilla and make it clear that Padilla's lack of defense was a bigger problem than
lack of footwork
was a bigger problem than Nelson's. I don't think Puella is gonna. I don't think he's gonna press that. I don't think he's gonna force that. And at that point, Padilla's got a good chin, and he does know how to meet people in the pocket with sharp shots.
Mm-hmm.
So I have more trust in that than I do Puella's very front foot aggressive style.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's really a problem for Padilla to have somebody who wants to walk into him. I think he likes
it. Yeah, that's what I'm saying is I think that is how his game, that is the one way his game truly functions.
Yeah. He had a huge amount of trouble with Kyle Nelson because Nelson had a couple good long range weapons, jabs, kicks.
Mm-hmm.
And because he knew how to pivot.
Yeah.
And sidestep, and Padilla just could not actually get him to stand still in front of him long enough to deliver one of those shots. I don't think Padilla minds a bit of a brawl at all if it means he gets to sling his combinations. And mm-hmm. yeah, I think he's a more considered, more accurate puncher than Pajuelo.
Mm-hmm.
Good uppercuts, good, great left hook, obviously. And yeah, Pajuelo just looks like a young brawler. So Padilla.
Yep. That's pretty much it. Padilla is the favorite here, opened at -156, currently -161, and Pajuelo opened at +122, currently +144. On that note, we are going to wrap things up. We'll be back with a little bonus content for Substack subscribers, so stick around for that. And if you're not already a Substack subscriber, sign up.
To access the bonus content of this episode, you must be a paid subscriber. To do that, go to themmadrawpodcast.substack.com and subscribe today.